We are home in the light of love. We are home in the light of love. We heal and sing. The
When two people get together, something new is born. And it's not just children. It's a new way of looking at the world. That's especially true of my guests today, Dave and Bess Nungarayi Price. She's a full-blood Aboriginal Walpuri woman from Yundamu in the Northern Territory. And he's an Irish Catholic from Newcastle, New South Wales. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to Couples in the Light of Love on the Spirit of Things, Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. Bess has been in the news lately as the chair of the Northern Territory Indigenous Affairs Advisory Council and as advisor to the National Council to Reduce Violence Against Women and Children. She's an advocate of the Northern Territory intervention. People are divided on its merits, but for Bess, the overriding concern is to stop the violence that's killing Indigenous Australians. This is what was going on in her life just before she went on ABC TV's Q&A program in April this year, making her case for the intervention.
One week was me attending the court case and supporting both families. This had to do with a young bloke who'd been stabbed in the town camp. That time as well, my sister-in-law was down in Adelaide. She had been stabbed in the head with a knife. And end of that week, she passed away. And then the weekend came and my brother's stepson, he apparently put his fist through the kitchen window and cut his wrist and he bled to death. And the week that I came back, my cousin's daughter had committed suicide. She was found hanging from a roof. So that's what I'd been putting up with, and a lot more has happened recently as well. So it's just constant. It never stops.
In the light of love, we are.
As an activist and advisor, Bess Price is trying to improve the conditions of Aboriginal Australians, and she's helped in that by her husband, Dave Price, a white fella. They've been together for over 30 years, and they have a daughter and three grandchildren. I went to see them in Alice Springs. Well, Bess and Dave Price, it's great to be in your home here in Alice Springs, and a privilege for me.
Welcome to Alice Springs.
Has this been your base as a couple since the beginning?
When we first got together, we moved three times, I think, until we decided to settle in Alice Springs. We lived on Melville Island in Snake Bay. Then we moved to Nookanbar in the Kimberleys for a couple of years. That's when we decided to move back to the territory. So we lived in Darwin for a bit. And then we decided to settle in Alice Springs in 1983.
Is it a good place to be, Dave?
Well, I love the place. For me, it's well and truly home now. We've brought our daughter up here. She was born in Darwin from up the top end, but she was only a toddler when she came here. You know, her whole life's here now.
Yes, although today, sadly, she's up. Sadly for me, she's back up in Darwin, isn't she?
That's right, yeah. She's got a work now that means she moves around as well. And, I mean, Territorians, we're like that. We have to travel a long way to get anywhere else, so we're used to it.
Well, Alice has been in the news a lot lately. How has it changed since you first settled here in the 80s?
In the 80s, I guess we were younger then, and Alice Springs was quiet, and that's the reason why we moved here. It was quite a beautiful little town, still is a beautiful town, but it was much, much quieter. But lots have happened since, and everybody be moving backwards and forwards, you know, coming to do whatever it is that they need to do in the town centre itself. Because we have a major hospital here, the Centrelink office is here. You know, when the small banks were closed in the communities, people had to come into Alice Springs to do their banking. There's always some kind of training happening for people. There's always meetings. So it's a busy little town for all sorts of reasons.
Well, Dave, I gather you're involved a lot in training, aren't you?
Yes, I do, we call it cross-culture awareness training. Bess and I both do this. We started off working together, but I do a lot on my own now because she's so busy with other things. But basically, we offer training to organisations that work with Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. So we give those people some background in culture, language, history of the place. Basically try to explain why we're the way we are.
Well, Bess, as chair of the Northern Territory Indigenous Affairs Advisory Council, you would be across just about everything that's happening here, and particularly the kinds of violence and problems that have been reported in the press recently. Can you tell me what a kind of average week or month would be for you, or maybe even a day is enough?
We are in the Northern Territory, and that's where everything and anything can happen. I'm always on the go the whole time, trying to understand what's happening out there. Just the other day, the Prime Minister was in Alice Springs, and Jenny Macklin as well, Warren Snowden, and Minister Kate Ellis was visiting. So it was a busy couple of days, and my council, the National Council that I sit on, Violence Against Women, were meeting here this week. I was busy. Plus, I get my family constantly ringing me to advise them on whatever it is they need help with. Plus, I've got my daughter and my grandchildren, so I'm busily running around trying to organise the grandchildren. And my brother's been staying with me, and I'm worried about him because he has to drive 800 kilometres to get here so he can get on the dialysis machine before he drives back out. So that's... And every day is something different happening for me. It's just constant. My life's just on the go the whole time.
It certainly sounds like it. And one of the things that has been in the news quite a lot is violence. Bess, how has that affected your family personally?
With violence, we're constantly surrounded by it. Our community's dealing with feuding right now as we speak. Both families are trying to work out a way to get together to solve this big problem that we have. And hopefully something might happen sooner than later.
Can I ask you, what's the feud about?
The feuding is to do with a death that occurred in a town camp. And that split whole of our community, my community, that's Yindamu. It's sad to see families go in that direction. But hopefully, as I said, I'm always hoping good things will come out of this.
I can't imagine how difficult it is for you to be an advocate for these issues that affect Aboriginal Australians generally, and also have it very much affect you personally. How do you cope with it?
There's nobody else around who'd be able to be the type of person who understands what needs to take place. And because of the other hats that I wear, the chair of the Indigenous Advisory Council for the Northern Territory, plus the National Council of Violence Against Women, I need to be an independent person that's needed so people can talk to me and seek advice from me. And that's what's been happening with both families who are feuding. They've asked me for advice, they've asked me for help. So I try and do my best to help both families.
Bess, your husband Dave is a white fella. Can you go to him for support in these very personal family issues? Is he part of the family?
He is. He's been a part of the family for 33 years, and most of my family's out in the Wadapri country, in the territory itself, all know him and more or less think of him as not a white fella. It's good to have Dave. I bounce all sorts of things off him, and he helps me understand, and he talks through all the problems with me, and which is good because he's a white fella and he can look at our problems from the white fella point of view, which is a totally different view from ours. And it's good to have him tell me, no, I would suggest or recommend that you do it this way or not that way. Which is great, and which is how we've managed to survive all this time.
Do you mean as a couple, in a sense?
Yeah, as a couple, and also physically, to some extent. Bess has been threatened with death on a few occasions. because her family, not now, but in the past, her family was caught up in similar feuding that's going on now, but feuds that have finished. But there were situations that she found herself in where she could have very easily been very seriously assaulted, and it could have led to death, because these things happen all the time. That hasn't happened to me, and I was interested when Bess said that, you know, her people, there's a lot of people that don't think of me as a white fella. In fact, I'm sure the reason I haven't directly, personally been caught up in it is because I'm a white fella. So that's an extra defence I have that Aboriginal people don't have. Always, number one concern for me was keeping the family together and protecting our household. So we regard this household as an island of safety and civilization, if you like, when things get bad. And Bess's family have always supported us in doing that. So right from the start, Bess's family have never expected me to try to act Aboriginal, if you like. They've always expected me to be white. Bess's parents' generation have huge respect for other people's law. So from the Aboriginal point of view, we're Warrabri, we have Warrabri country, we have our law. I don't know, they're different. They have their country, they have their law. You know, I've just come back from Jabiru. Mira, Kunjaitmi, speaking Mira, they have their law, which is totally different from other people's law. So there's this recognition that we're all different and we all have our own law. So they're quite happy to deal with white people as white people with their own law. It's helped immensely, I think, also being male, because Warrabri is a pretty male-dominated society, at least on the public level. Women have huge influence as well, of course. And so her family has been happy that Bess has followed my path to some extent, as long as I've been willing to respect their law and to respect them as a people and to respect them as an individual. They're very happy that I'm part of the family.
But that must make some areas completely frustrating. I mean, you can't always accept somebody else's law, particularly if it involves danger to your wife.
Yeah, absolutely. But I express that too. I don't hold back. When I'm teaching about cultures, I do make the point right from the start. Look, you don't have to like the other culture. You know, I don't teach white fellas about Aboriginal culture so that they will adopt Aboriginal beliefs and practice. That's not it at all. There are aspects of Bess's culture that if I could change tomorrow, I would. And there are aspects to my culture that if Bess could change tomorrow, she would. And we both understand that. And
well, hopefully you agree on which should be changed in either.
Not always. In fact, there's a lot of things we agree to disagree about. And, you know, in what marriage don't you do that, huh? If you want a marriage to stay together, you've got to learn how to do that. So, look, there are younger men who I argue with quite a lot. They call me father, and I call them son. And they do things I don't like, and I tell them I don't like it, and I behave in a very white way. I behave in ways that a Warrabri father would not behave. And I know that, and they know that. One of my sons in particular has said to me several times, "You're a hard man, Dave." And I say, "Thanks very much. I can only try." And on several occasions he's also said, "You are just like my grandfather." And that's Bess's father, my father-in-law. When he says that, he's not saying, "You hold Warrabri law, you behave as a Warrabri." I think he's saying, "You're a cranky old man like my grandfather, and you're determined to follow your own law like my grandfather." And he respects that. So we're in that bicultural situation, and I think a lot of white fellas make the mistake that when they come here, they think they have to cringe, if you like, you know, they have this veneration for Aboriginal culture. And my attitude's quite simple. My culture's as good as yours. I'm not here to change you, but I am here to defend my family. And if that means we have to run our household in a particular way and it's going to be different from the way you do it, that's what I'm going to do. Everybody respects that.
Well, let me go back to when you weren't a cranky old man and you were all younger and in love. How did you meet and what were the circumstances of that?
Dave came out in 1976. He was married and I was married at the time as well and had a small child. We all worked at the school. My marriage wasn't working at the time and Dave's wasn't, so we decided to get together and leave. So we did that. At the time I was studying to be a teacher, actually. It was Easter and I had to fly back from Darwin. And it was all arranged because my dear sister, who's now passed on, she made sure that she was going to help me get together with Dave. I flew back from Darwin, I met up with Dave, and then we drove to Newcastle. And that was exciting for me as well, because I was this, I didn't know what to expect. You're just thinking back to the time, we were taking a risk. We were both taking a risk. Absolutely. And we just didn't know what to expect. But here we are, and we're still going strong, I guess.
Mm. Well, Dave, I think you come from a Irish Catholic background, is that right?
Yeah.
How did your parents react to you? Were they in any way surprised?
No, I don't think they were surprised at all. My mother and father separated when I was just 5 years old. So my father was still around, but he wasn't really part of the family. But my mother warned me when I was a young man and said, "Dave, you should marry one of your own kind, because it's hard enough then," she says, which of course is true. Don't make it harder. But she was talking about Protestant and Catholic. She didn't care about colour, as long as you were a Catholic. And I broke that rule and I married a Protestant, and she was right, it was disastrous. But I married too young. But when my marriage collapsed, that didn't surprise my family at all. In Bess's situation, her family had expected her to go to a promised husband when she was very young, when she was only 13. A promised husband was already married to her older sister, so she would have been going to a sister's household. He was, early 40s, wasn't he? Bess is a rebel. She rebelled and wouldn't be in it. Her promised husband and her father relented and allowed her to do that. They were a couple of softies. and so from their point of view, the marriage that Bess had entered into wasn't optimal, if you like. So when hers fell apart, both families supported us in doing what we're doing. Neither families were happy with their previous marriages. Well, I negotiated with Bess's family and asked their permission. I wasn't going to take Bess anywhere without their permission. Everybody, including the old promised husband, supported us, agreed to it.
Bess, I want to ask you about that being promised to an older man who was married to your sister at the time, so you would have been a kind of second wife. And you were very young, 13. What gave you the gumption to say, "No, I don't want this"?
In a way, I was influenced by going to school when I was younger and learning about what you could have outside of your immediate culture. I had a friend in school out at Yindamu who was white, and I hung out with her and her family most of the time when I was growing up in Yindamu. And I guess that gave me a different view of how people could live. That gave me this feeling, or this gut feeling, that I wanted to explore. And when I met Dave, when we got together, he gave me the opportunity to do so, to be able to learn about the rest of the world and learn about how you could live together and enjoy life differently from the way that my people lived.
Remember the day we ran away. We were together, friends forever.
This is Couples in the Light of Love on The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National.
We ran away.
Bess Nungabrai Price is married to Dave Price, and together they're cross-cultural consultants based in Alice Springs. As chair of the Northern Territory Indigenous Affairs Advisory Council, Bess is often preoccupied with advocacy work, especially on the prevention of violence toward women and children. As a young person, though, were you troubled by the sort of practices you saw around you? Were you at all troubled by young girls married to older men?
I did see a young girl being dragged off to her promised husband's place, and I was disturbed because her family lived, we were close-knitted family, so they lived with us as well. I remember waking up the next morning to go to school. I saw these drag marks on the ground from where he just dragged her all the way to his camp, and I didn't realise that, how harsh it could be. Being promised an older man and being forced to go and live with him. But that relationship worked well. The couple, the young girl, she was a third wife, and they all lived together happily. And that's how it's supposed to work out, I guess. You get to know, you get to love the promised husband as you get older with him. I think that's how marriages worked. Mm. And with other wives as well, you all get to know each other and become family.
It wasn't like that when you were married, though. You have said that you bear the scars of your earlier life physically on your body. Was it a violent marriage?
Yeah, that's right. It was a violent marriage, and it was always when alcohol was involved. I had to put up with that for 4 years. And when Dave came and he suggested I live with him, I just took that chance because I wanted a better life for myself as well and for my little son, because I had a son as well who was 1 year old, I think, when Dave came, because it was 1976.
And you took him?
He came with us and lived with us for 5 years. And my sister took care of him in the early stages when Dave and I had to leave. But he joined up with us when we were living on Melville Island and came and lived with us up there on the island.
And what happened to him?
When we decided to move back to Alice Springs in 1983, he'd become ill. We hadn't realised it, but he was diagnosed with leukemia. And it was 1984 when we lost him. When our daughter was 4 years old, we all had to pack up and move down to Adelaide because he had to go through chemotherapy. And we didn't have that here in Alice Springs, so most of the Territorians have to go down to Adelaide. And we had to go live down there for a couple of months, and while he was being treated at the children's hospital down there.
How did you both cope with that?
I was young then, I didn't know. I was just in a daze, I think, the whole time. Mm-hmm. And my big sister came down and supported us. And I think she carried me through. She carried me through all that. I'm grateful to my sister because she showed me how to mourn and supported me, my mum and dad as well. But it was a learning curve for all of us.
Yeah. How about you, Dave?
Yeah. Let me say, following on all that Bess has just said, I'd like to say that there are those who think of me as rescuing Bess from a difficult situation, a difficult marriage, but I very much see it the other way around. When I met Bess, she was a 16-year-old with a 2-year-old son, and she was literally, I'd say, the most emotionally mature and strongest person I've ever met, and I was 10 years older. So apart from the fact that she's gorgeous, of course, which helps, but I was hugely attracted to her as a personality and the strength she had in her. I've got to say that the loss of my son almost destroyed me. One thing that Aboriginal people are very, very good at, it's mourning and grieving. They get a hell of a lot of practice. The way they do it is just wonderful. It works really, really well, and I didn't have that. My family tried to support me as much as they could from a distance, but I was up here alone, and I had my daughter. My daughter helped, having a daughter helped immensely. But Bess didn't go to the burial with me because mothers don't go to the burial of their children. So my mother was with me, but that's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But for me, the really important thing that came out of all that was that I felt that I'd been supporting Bess. I saw that as my main job, to support her. And then when she started coming good, I crashed. I don't want to sound critical or harsh, but I don't think Bess didn't know how to support me through that, because the Aboriginal way of doing it, I should have been surrounded by male kin and going through the same sorts of things that Bess was going through, but separately. That's how they do it.
Well, then where did you find support? Traditionally, one finds it in the church. A minister can offer that kind of succor. Where was the church in all of this, in your lives?
Not there at all. I was brought up as a Catholic. That's my heritage, and I'm quite proud of being brought up in that heritage. It's as good as anybody else's. And the other thing I like to say is it gives you something really substantial to rebel against as an adolescent, You can really get your teeth into it. But I think both Bess and I spent a lot of time trying to sort through the unnecessary dross of it all, I guess, down to the core of what it's all about, the jewel that we all look for, if you like. And we talk a lot about how I was brought up religiously and how Bess was brought up in her tradition, and we spent a lot of time trying to find out, well, what is it that we both share? Where's the common ground? Now, in the case of Aboriginal stuff, you've got to go through a lot of layers to get to that point, but we believe we've found it. So when I say Bess couldn't support me, I did draw an awful lot of strength from her. That's true. But what I realised was that what destroyed my father was what was destroying me. He left school when he was 13. He was an unskilled labourer, basically an uneducated man. One thing that did sustain me was I remember my mother saying to me that he was a model father and husband until my sister died. I'll get over this in a minute. My sister, she was 6 years old and died of diphtheria when I was 18 months old, and while my mother was giving birth to a ninth child. My mother said that your dad supported me all the way through that, but when she came good, I'll get over this anyway. Yeah, when she came good, he went down and never came back to us. He lost his sanity, literally.
Were you afraid of doing that when your son died? Were you afraid you'd go down that road?
Not really. I think what it did for me was made me understand what was happening to me. I felt my old man's spirit was there with me. It was the first time in my life I actually understood him. This was after his death. He'd died before that. Bess said, why don't you just go and have a holiday or something? So I went down to Adelaide and took our daughter with us. And I went to see the modern-day priest, the social worker, the counsellor. That counsel was absolutely wonderful. She worked at the Children's Hospital in Adelaide, and the Children's Hospital in Adelaide has saints working for us. They're just beautiful people, and I don't know how on earth they managed to do it. But so I went down, I sat at her desk and blubbered like a kid, and I started talking, and it all comes out. You start crying, you start talking about your childhood, and where the hell's all this coming from? And after I'd done that for about half an hour, and thought I was being incoherent and half crazy, she said to me, well, actually, this happens to every family that loses a child, and you and Bess are doing really well. That's all it took. From then on, I started coming back up again.
Well, just a bit of encouragement. But may I also say, behind me on the wall is a lovely tanka of Tara, the Buddhist female bodhisattva. Mm-hmm. Is there a bit of Buddhism that has come into your lives?
Yes. I've read a lot of Joseph Campbell, and I've read a lot of Carl Jung, and a lot of their ideas have helped me hugely, and especially Joseph Campbell working through what the symbols of religion mean, and what I just love about his work, ex-Catholic, by the way, is the way he finds the truth, if you want to call it that, in every religion. That, you know, he calls religions the masks of God, and a religion is a mask over the face of God. That really, really appeals to me. And of all the religions I've read about, it's the tranquility of Buddhism that appeals to me. The idea of you conquer pain, that all life is sorrowful, it's supposed to be sorrowful. And that understanding helped me through the grieving. When our son died, I found that the question that always comes to everybody's mind, why us, why me, you can turn that around, and the equal and obvious question is, why not me? Every person we spoke to, everybody, could give us a story, a similar story of what had happened to their family.
Bess, do you find some solace in the Buddhist acceptance of pain and death as an inevitable part of life? Do you find it comforting?
It has been for me. As Dave mentioned, he and I talk a lot about death and spirituality. He's influenced me in understanding how other religious cultures view the world. And I guess I've chosen Buddhism because it brings peace, harmony and enlightenment, and it's not as harsh as what I'd seen while I was going through the Baptist, you know, going to church, the Baptist church at Yundamoo when I was growing up. It's totally different. And I've taken to Buddhism because that's what gives me... I've had families who come and say, why have you got this prayer flow? Why have you got a Buddha out there? And I said, oh, do you pray to Buddha every night? And I said, no, it's there to remind me that you can choose to live differently if you want to. And I tell them, look, this makes me happy inside. Having Buddha and having Tara makes it better environment for me because I feel at peace. And that's why I tell my families as well, because they've got themselves involved with these other religious groups, Assembly of God, Pentecostal, all these church groups that have come into their world, and it's so different. And my family, you know, they don't really understand what Christianity is all about. They don't, you know. I was even talking to my auntie the other day she calls herself a Baptist, a Christian. And then she tells me that your niece's daughter, she's sick, and I think she's sick because someone did sorcery on her. And I said, look, you call yourself a Christian. I said, yeah. Well, maybe you should start talking about why you are a Christian and what you believe in, and talk about God's word, and instead of having to listen to people who are always talking about sorcery and always talking about bad things and evil things, you should turn them around and say no, and you should start being the Christian that you call yourself. I think there's a lot of confusion out there with our people with Christianity.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, mentioning sorcery, how prevalent is that? Because, may I say, you know, Aboriginal culture is presented in schoolrooms and on tours as idyllic, romantic, harmonious, the perfect kind of religion. Mm. And I know that you have some doubts about that.
We're always surrounded by sorcery. Someone in the family is always talking about it. In the old days, that's how they kept children close to them. You know, they weren't allowed to go outside of the light, the fire, the campfires. That's how they scare young kids. If they're misbehaving, they'll say, oh, you know, this monster, Gugu, is going to come and get you if you don't behave. So they always use that. It's funny because now I think of it, I was thinking about people talking how overcrowding in these houses and there's nowhere else for people to sleep, and you know, was thinking more or less around sorcery, and said, I know why they all want to sleep together, because they're always scared of the dark. They're always talking about somebody coming to get them in the middle of the night, or somebody doing sorcery to them. That's why they all, you know, they don't think it's overcrowding. That's the reason why they all sleep 20 to a house. You never would find, you know, a single person living in a house, three-bedroom house or two-bedroom house. It's always, it has to be someone else living with you. What we say, malpa. Malpa is, you know, company in Walfrey. Always have to have malpa. You always have to have, you know, people living with you. You can't just be, you know, living in a house by yourself. It's just you and your husband and your kids, because they'll think that's strange. Yeah.
Well, it must be a bit of a challenge then for you two to keep this place a sanctuary for yourselves.
No, it's not difficult. Two reasons. One is that I've been told several times by Warrabi people that sorcery doesn't bother me because I'm a white fella. I've said to them, once when Bess and I first got together, we were travelling up to Darwin and we had our son with us and another young Warrabi woman, or girl really then. We camped. I went off to get firewood, came back. Everybody's in the car with the windows wound up and the doors locked. So I say, I thought you'd get your camp gear out and we'd get the fire going. Bess says, this is very early in our relationship, Bess said, we heard whistling. Ah, okay, you heard whistling. That means there's somebody out there. There's the Kadacha whistles when he wants to scare people, you know. This is a warning. So I said, I didn't hear whistling. She says, that's because you're white. Oh, okay. So I said, well, I'll take our chances with the Kadacha, so we're going to camp here. The next morning, I said, everybody in one piece? My wife says to me, yeah, but that's because you're here. So I said, stick with me, baby, we'll take them on. Ever since then, I've deliberately said that. I said, look, this doesn't bother me. You know, what I say to people is, look, this stuff will kill you only if you believe it. No, I don't believe it, so we're safe. But the other thing is, funnily enough, we also turn that around a bit. We've had people tell us that they've sensed spirits in this house, the souls of dead people in this house. And our reaction's quite straightforward. We say, oh, yeah, they're here. They look after us, you know. Don't worry about dead people. They're fine. It's the living ones you've got to worry about. And
Dave Price, the other half of Bess Nungarai Price. Their home is Alice Springs, but sometimes they get away from it all.
And down there, there's the creek bed that we come and often camp. So when Dave and I want to escape ourselves away from our daughter and grandchildren, we go down and camp down there in the riverbed.
It's absolutely gorgeous. And we're looking at a whole stretch of mountains or low mountains.
That's Mount Gillon and Aranda. Their connection to this part of the country, the Jugurpa, the dreaming, is the caterpillar dreaming. So the essence of the caterpillars are still here in the range. Mm. And that's why Alice Springs is called the caterpillar dreaming, where the caterpillars came and met. Mm. And the heavy tree gap, that's where you drive through to go out to the airport and to the southern side of Alice Springs. Right. Then as you keep going east, you come to Jesse Gap. And on the other side of Jesse Gap is the community called Mungana, where Aboriginal people who were, some of them were traditional owners for this part of Alice Springs, claimed to be as their hometown.
That's Emily Gap.
Oh, did I say Emily Gap?
No, you said Jesse. No.
That's Emily Gap, okay, so sorry. But if you go further east, you come to Jesse Gap, and the big mountain over there is Mount Undulia. And if you go keep going east, you will get to Ross River and Trafina Gorge, Ruby Gorge. The road takes it all the way around, and you can do a loop back through Yamba Station or the Garden, Yamba, and back to Stewart Highway. And you've got Bond Springs, and then you've got Telegraph Station, and then you've got Alice Springs. So that's the whole circle.
It is.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you here, Rachel, to share this part of the country with you.
Well, thank you.
Dave calls it the navel of the universe.
Bess and Dave Price on a brilliant sunny day at their favorite lookout outside of Alice Springs. They're our couple in focus, and you can see them on our website and download the audio while you're there at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings.
In the light of love, we are whole in the light.
Bess and Dave's marriage made a difference not just to themselves, but to the community, where they're trying to change a cultural outlook that leads to violence, poverty, and early death.
Bess, you really have been on a campaign to try to change Aboriginal culture in some very profound ways. What are the chief things that you would really like to change, to drop, to leave behind, to say, look, it doesn't work now?
Well, for instance, people should have their own houses, look after their immediate family and not look after the whole family. We have that culture where we're always giving to people. And if we were to move away from that, I'm sure it would be much, much better from how it is now. Because of that, it's kept our people down. And we haven't been able to make the right proper decisions in order to survive. That's one I'd like to see change. I'd like to see more and more people saying, no, I've worked. I've earned enough money to have this four-wheel drive. It's mine. I can't give it to anybody. I can't give it to my sister. I won't lend it to my brother-in-law. And I won't let anybody else drive it except me. You know, they're the things that I'd like people to think about and to make up their mind whether they want to keep giving their four-wheel drives to families to wreck or to just say no. I want people to think about saying no for a change and saying, no, you can't come and eat all my food. I paid for it. I work for it in order to have food in the fridge for my family. And for people to say no when family turn up and want to stay with you, to say no. These are people in the town camps I'm thinking about. For them to turn people away and say, you're my cousin, but right now I just want to have my family living with me, my immediate family living with me. And for our people to say, no, I can't give you money because you will spend it on grog. If they started, you know, making those small changes, I think then people would make people realise that they have to do something for themselves, not expect everybody else to look after them.
Does that involve change to fundamental kinship responsibilities and lore?
That's right. That's right. We've got this kinship system that's throughout the Northern Territory and some parts of WA. in Queensland and South Australia, and that in itself is a trap. And we haven't been able to move further than, you know, where we are now because of that whole culture that we have that keeps us down. I think what needs to take place is our people need to move outside of their comfort zone and to face the challenges and to be able to work it through themselves. That's what I would like to see.
I think what you said before about, you know, the idealised version of Aboriginal culture that's now taught, particularly in the cities, it really does get in the way of solving problems. We call it the Disneyland version of Aboriginal culture. It's dehumanising. It's absurd. There's no human culture like that anywhere on earth, and it's been produced for white fellas who were yearning for some utopia and people who call themselves stolen generation who idealise what was taken from them. What we should be saying is, look, we understand that you have this aspect to your culture. In the present situation, we don't believe it works very well for the following reasons. What do you think? Would you like to change it? Now, what Bess mentioned is the really obvious one, what we call the demand-share economy. Europeans were doing it 7,500 years ago too. When we were hunter-gatherers, we did it. All hunter-gatherers do it. So what Bess is talking about, the ethic that says, well, look, I work for this, for my family, and if I don't plan it properly, my kids will go hungry, and I'm not about to do that. I'm not about to hand my money over to you so you can go and spend it on grog or gamble or whatever you do just because you happen to be my kinsman. That does involve an absolutely fundamental change to people's ethics and economic view. Yes, it does. In the training that we do, we often have Aboriginal people in that room and we discuss these issues and I ask them, what do you think? Tell me about your circumstances. We have not yet had an Aboriginal person disagree with us. This is the point. They understand immediately what we're talking about and usually people say, yes, that's a problem. We've got to do something about it. White fellas should examine what's going on their side and make changes they need to make, but there's got to be changes on the other side because no matter what white fellas do, their problems will still be there until Aboriginal people say, yes, we have this problem. The wonderful thing about changing your own culture is it's your own business, your own responsibility, and nobody can do it for you. So it's something that Aboriginal people can do for themselves. We should be able to do that in a situation of genuine dialogue based on mutual respect. That is what we would like to see happen.
And yet these very issues are the ones that have recently divided Aborigines. And of course, we recently saw the coverage of Louisa Barron's outrageous comment on Twitter as a response to Bess's appearance on ABC's Q&A. How do you cope with that kind of vicious divide? It must be extremely hurtful, Bess.
Well, when it first came out, I felt angered by it all. I've never met her, and she doesn't know me or my history. For her to say that was an insult, and it angered a lot of people, other Aboriginal people as well, all over Australia, even in the Northern Territory. About people who are the same colour as her, Aboriginal, but they're Territorians who've come to me and said, we support you, Bess, and you have the right to say what you said. And it's your opinion, and everybody is allowed to have their own opinion without being attacked. There are people here in Northern, even in Alice Springs, have come and said, you know, we support you, we know what you're talking about, and how dare she has a go at you. That's been raging, I think, ever since that day that she said that about me. But for me, it took me a week to get over it and say, no, you know nothing about our people up in the Northern Territory. You're not insulting me, you're insulting everybody else as well who I speak for.
I've been saying for years we've got two big problems. One's racism, one's political correctness. They're two sides of the same coin. Neither of them are interested in truth. We're interested in truth. I think in the universities down south, the whole thing's been hijacked by a white radical way of thinking and arguing. It doesn't work. It's wrong. It's based on falsehoods. It's based on stereotypes. The ones that most infuriate me are the white women we know who have been attacking Bess on the internet, sometimes obscenely, openly calling her a liar, who are white women, but they use skin names as pseudonyms, and they try really hard to appear to be Aboriginal by the use of the language. Everybody up here has said to Bess, Townies, Bushies, who cares? Aboriginal, white, everybody has said to Bess, we support you. Several have said, Bess, we don't agree with everything you say about the intervention, but you have the right to say it. Everybody has said that. So that what we're interested in is a frank and honest debate, a real debate, where you can say what you believe. If you can convince us we're wrong, fine. Right. Don't just scream abuse at us. Don't try to close us down. Don't try to close the debate down. The ones that infuriate me most are the ones who call themselves human rights activists. And the very first thing they do, if you give an opinion that's different from theirs, is try to close you down, try to stop you from speaking. And they call themselves human rights activists.
You know, if people sat together and learnt about each other, I think it'd be a much better world. Mm.
Well, indeed. I mean, you are an interracial couple. Do you think, in a way, you are a model for what could be, what you'd like to see as the true Australian, the Australians who are not really defined by colour, but are defined by shared values?
I've never thought of us as being modelling in any way, but the ones I do see as models are our children. We keep meeting extremely wise and smart and tough-minded young people who come from marriages like ours, who come from families like ours. So our daughter, I'm immensely proud of our daughter. And this bush-town divide thing, we talk about bushies as being first language and Aboriginal language, close to the traditions, townies, first language English, living in the suburbs, holding down jobs. Our daughter's a townie and Bess is a bushie. We're not only just a white, black family. I'm a white fella, Bess is a bush black fella, our daughter is a town black fella. That's how we see it. Our grandsons are our townies. Our grandsons are white black fellas. That's what we call them. They're physically white. They call themselves black fellas. Good on you. Terrific. We know a lot of young people like that, and they're the ones that we put a lot of hope in them. I hope we don't burden them too much with that.
But do you see them actually carrying forward this kind of integrated notion where Aboriginal culture is transformed, modernised, adapted to a new world?
Exactly. Because they come from households, bicultural households, they understand what culture is. But they're not afraid to make their own decisions. So, you know, in our daughter's case, she says, yeah, my mother's Warrawarri, I'm proud. I know where my country is. I know what my dreamings are. I was conceived on Melville Island. I've got crocodile dreaming. That Tiwi mob claim me too. I know about that. But my father's white, and I know about the white world too. We've brought her up to think of herself as a citizen of the world. In a way, we're expecting them to make their own culture, which is an awfully tough thing to ask of a human being, but they're doing it. And that is what's wonderful about our country. That's what's wonderful about Australia.
Well, looking at the two of you and also the kind of work you do, it's all about learning.
Yes.
And yes. I just wonder... Bess, it's obvious that you've learned a lot from Dave's Anglo-Celtic culture. And Dave, I want to know, how much have you learned from Aboriginal culture? I know you can say a few words in language. You are a linguistics graduate, after all.
What I've learned most, I think, is the intense humanity of Aboriginal people and their modern humanity. I see Aboriginal people as being quintessentially modern humans. The notion of primitiveness just doesn't work for me at all. And one of the things I most respect about Aboriginal culture is their ability to cope with pain, their ability to mourn and to grieve. But at the same time, they, as a people, are in real trouble and they're calling out for help. So I really try hard not to romanticise them too much. You'll meet philosophers, you'll meet wise people, you'll meet lunatics, you'll meet out-and-out criminals. You'll meet, you know, the whole range of humanity is there in one little community. Knowing Bess's culture, knowing as much as I do about Bess's culture, has made me far more confident and proud of who I am, funnily enough.
And in all of this, it's not just about the exchange of information and understanding. It's also about love. It's about love. Conquering all those differences.
That's right. And I always tell Dave, yeah, funnily enough, I always tell him, Dave, you're like my promised husband. You know, raised me, taught me, and I'm still learning from Dave. And everything that I talk about these days, or how, you know, the more vocal I've become, is because Dave's always convinced me that I can do what I want to do. I can be the independent person I want to be and speak openly and freely about anything and everything. This is what I wouldn't have been able to achieve, I think, if I'd lived at Yindamu. It's made me stronger, although I might have been stronger in a different way if I'd lived at Yindamu. But just being with Dave, it's just I can see in the middle and I can see both worlds, you know.
That's Bess Price. But what about love? How did Dave change her view of love?
You don't openly hug, kiss, hold hands. You know, you don't see that in our culture. For the first 15 years of our life, I wouldn't allow Dave to kiss me openly in front of people at airports or wherever, in the streets, or even hug me. It took me that long to get used to him showing me affection. It's funny because often I'm out at Yindamu and I want to hug and kiss my little family members and they get a shock when I give them a hug and tell them I love them and they look at me and, you know, it's kind of a shock to them to actually have that frank openness about showing affection to your people. I tell them I love them, and my nephews and said, oh, she's talking to me. Oh, she said that. And I said, oh, I don't know. Turn around with a big smile and said, yeah, I love you. So it's a funny kind of reaction you get from family members. And I encourage that. You know, this is how you do it. You know, hug the child. Yeah, tell them you love them. Just to stop them from being aggressive. You know, do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's funny. It's really funny to watch the reaction.
Well, love is certainly one of the best ways, probably the best way, of assuaging the pain of a lot of people, Aboriginal people, who are suffering today. And I want to thank you both for providing such a sterling, such an inspiring example of love and also understanding across the cultures. Bess Noongarai Price and Dave Price, thank you so much for allowing me to come into your sanctuary, your sanctuary here in Alice Springs.
Thank you for coming in and sharing it with us.
Yeah.
You are good, Rachel. Thank you.
A remarkable couple, Bess Noongarai Price and her husband, Dave Price, who you can see on our website at abc.net.au/rn/spiritofthings. And while you're there, download the audio and also add your comment, choosing today's program and following the prompts. And you can also have a look at David Bush's video of my day with the Dalai Lama at Chen Rezig. It's a Spirit of Things first. Next week, another twosome, but they're two women who could be mother and daughter, but they're just best friends. One is Jewish-Israeli, the other is Palestinian-Muslim, and together they search for common ground in Israel and in the Palestinian territories. They're Sharon Rosen and Suher Rasool. Don't miss them next week on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Kahn.
And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I wanna hear it. I don't have to fear it, and I wanna rock your gypsy soul, just like way back in the days of old.